Man first scratched his letters onto the side of rocks. Later he learned to use a stylus to cut into soft clay, and he learned to bake and harden that clay. For most of the last 3,000 years, probably 5/6 of that time, man used dyes or inks to inscribe his letter on strips of parchment or of papyrus or of linen. When his letters ran to excessive length, he would write them on succeeding pieces or strips of parchment or papyrus and sew these strips together and roll them into a scroll for convenience in carrying and in storing. Our Bible was first written on such sewn together strips of parchment. We have a reverent testimony to this in the Torah, which graces our ark. For the Torah still is written in the ancient manner. Strips of dried skin, sewn together, and handwritten. To think of our Torah is to be conscious of the bulkiness, the cumbersomeness of these ancient volumes. After all, the Torah contains only 5 of the 36 books in our Bible. Imagine the difficulty in carrying or in reading from a single scroll on which a scribe might have inscribed all of the 36 texts. My point is this. We think of the Bible now as a single edited volume, an anthology of the revealed, inspired religious literature of our people. Originally, the Bible was not considered as a single volume, but was known to the people rather as a series of separate scrolls, inspired and revealed scrolls, certainly, but separate, not bound together in any organized form, not evidencing any unity of structure. Nor is this only a matter of surmise. We have found in the famous Dead Sea Caves near Kirbet Qumran many a biblical text from the first century before the Common Era. And every text that has been found there evidences this single fact, that the books of the Bible were written on separate scrolls, that these scrolls were stored independently, one of the other. During most of the 4th and the 3rd and the 2nd centuries before the Common Era, there was much discussion, therefore, and debate within the Jewish community as to which of the scrolls of religious literature deserved to be canonized, deserved to be considered as holy scripture. As there was no single volume of the Bible, there was much and continuous debate. And some of the books, which are now included in our text, almost did not achieve that elevated position. Most of our volumes certainly were by the 3rd or 2nd century before the Common Era, so revered by our ancestors that there was no question of their admission. But of others, there was much question. Many of the religious leaders of that day felt, for instance, that the wonderful love poetry of the Song of Songs was much too earthy to be considered as biblical. Others felt that the pious, realistic wisdom of the Book of Proverbs was somewhat too mundane to be considered as divinely inspired. And still others felt that the pessimistic philosophy of the book of Ecclesiastes did not fit in with the general tenor and outlook of Jewish thought. Other books also came under question. And it was a matter of 4 or 5 centuries of continuous debate and discussion before a general consensus had been achieved as to which of these separate scrolls deserved to be considered as canonical, as part of the revealed word of God. I would turn your attention this morning not to the books, the scrolls, which became part of our sacred scripture, these you know full well, but to those scrolls which were denied admission. They are worthy of our consideration for the very fact of their having been considered testify certainly to their high order of literary creativity, of artistry, and to their essential piety and religious fervor. Why were these books not admitted into the biblical canon? In the first place, some of them were not able to sustain throughout that high level of literary excellency which the Bible so magnificently displayed. And they had simply to be denied a position in the canon because they were deemed to be inferior works, works whose admission into the Bible would somehow lower the whole level of the biblical literature. Secondly, some of these books were of rather late composition. The authors of some of these books were near contemporaries of those who were editing the Bible. And it was hard for these men to consider that men of the third or fourth centuries, men whose histories and biographies were known, were actually divinely inspired when they set down their books or their writings. And finally, some of these works were written by pious Jews, but Jews who had followed one or another of a variety of religious Jewish sects, of groups which had emphasized one aspect of Jewish life or another, of groups who essentially had emphasized messianism, millenarianism, the end of the world and the coming of the Messiah, of groups whose basic tendencies and philosophies were not always in keeping with the philosophic foundations of Jewish life. And these books, despite their moral earnestness and their religious fervor, had to be denied a place in our Bible because they misemphasized elements in Jewish life. And if they had been acceded to and accepted, later generations might have misinterpreted the basic direction of Jewish thought. These books, which were rejected by our ancestors from a place in the Bible, are known simply as the Sefarim HaChitzonim, the hidden books, the books which were set aside. For reasons which we shall see shortly, they were never drawn together by our ancestors into a religious anthology, and they did not for centuries occupy any central place in Jewish thought, nor did they contribute to the development of that thought. How is it then that these books survive to us today? Their history is an interesting one. Really, it is a paradox. They survive to us not because they were revered by Jews as having been products of the Jewish creative genius, but because they were revered by the Christian church, who found in many of these books doctrines compatible with and sympathetic with their own teachings and world outlook. If you were to pick up a Roman Catholic Bible today, you would find in that Bible, on an equal level, on a par with the books of the Old and New Testament, such books of the Apocrypha as Tobit and Judith, the Wisdom of Solomon, the Wisdom of Ben Sirach, which they would call Ecclesiasticus, and many another. Because the Christian church was not adverse to seeing inspiration in contemporary documents. After all, the Gospels were newer even than any of the books of the Apocrypha. And the Christian church, after all, grew out of a millenarian messianic Jewish sect. And the visions of such Jewish sects and their hopes and their fears and their flights of fancy quite understandably was compatible with and understandable to the early Christian church. The Christian church looked on these books of the Apocrypha as a bridge between the Old and the New Testament and ascribed to these books of the Apocrypha an inspiration equal to that of the books of the Old Testament. We will return shortly to this paradox of Christian acceptance and Jewish denial of products of the Jewish creative genius. But for the moment, I would like to give you some broad perspective and understanding of the beauty and of the artistry which can be found in the Apocrypha itself. Perhaps we would be well to start with an event in history of which we are all familiar, the events which led up to the festival of Hanukkah, the great Maccabean revolt against the Syrian Greeks, which began in the year 165 before the Common Era. You'll recall that the catalyst to this revolt, the cause, was an order by the Syrian Greek emperor Antiochus Epiphanes that idols of Zeus were to be set up in all the high places and synagogues and temples of his empire. The Jews rebelled. They refused to bow down to an idol. And yet, certainly, many timid in heart must have sought for some rationalization, some excuse which would permit them to accede to the will of the emperor. To rebel is a final dangerous act. And those who were timid and lacked courage must have sought for some out, some excuse to obey the emperor's will. Now, many of the priests of the idol temples had ready explanations of the power of the idols, and they had devised systems whereby the miraculous powers of these idols seemed to be made apparent day by day to the people. The nostrils of these idols were so constructed that they sometimes were able to breathe smoke and fire. The mouth of these idols was sometimes so built that it seemed as if a voice was welling up out of the deep and actually speaking to the worshiper. And one of the most common and ordinary of these magical tricks by which the credulous were awestruck was a process whereby the votive offerings, the daily offerings of food and drink and of money which were placed before the idol by the pious, were closed into the temple compound at night. When the morning would come, the altar would be empty, seemingly emptied by supernatural hands. One of the first of the masters of scientific detection literature, an unknown Jew some 2,200 years ago, wrote a wonderful little novelette, which appears in our Apocrypha, in which he tried to reveal and make apparent the sham of all these shabby tricks by which idol priests tried to emphasize the miraculous powers of their gods. He set the scene in Persia a few centuries before, in a Persia ruled by King Cyrus, beloved of the Jews because it was he who had permitted the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. The hero of this little novelette, the Sherlock Holmes of the story, is the biblical hero Daniel, famous for his trials within the lion's den. Daniel, because of his wit and his wisdom, had achieved a position of some prominence in the Persian court. And one day, during a discussion of points of view and of philosophy, Cyrus, the Persian king, turned to Daniel and asked him why it was that he alone of all his courtiers would not worship at the temple of the patron god of the Persians, Bel. And Daniel answered that he could not bow to any idol, only the one holy God of spirit, the God of the Jews, was worthy of worship. And the king laughed at Daniel's disbelief. And he turned to Daniel and said, how can you disbelieve in a God who daily performs miracles? Do not each night the votive offerings which are placed before this God of ours disappear, taken unto him by his own supernatural powers? Daniel again scoffed and denied this which the king and all his courtiers believed. And the king, full of his power and full of anger, told Daniel to prove his case under forfeit of his life. And the court adjourned to the great temple of the god Bel. They entered the temple. They saw there the piles of sacrifices which had been brought by the faithful. They ordered the priests of the temple to bow themselves out. One by one, Daniel and Cyrus went around the inner doors of the temple and sealed each gate with a royal seal. And then they too left from the temple, certain that no one was there. And Cyrus turned to Daniel with a threat. If on the morrow, in the morning, when we open the doors of this temple, if the seals have not been tampered with, then truly You must admit that Bel is all-powerful. It will be an admission which you will have to make under cost of your life. Comes the dawn. Daniel and the court and Cyrus and the priests of Bel make a circuit of the temple. Every gate is sealed. The seal on each gate is unbroken. Cyrus orders the seal on the main gate to be broken. He and Daniel enter into the temple compound. They walk to the altar. The altar is empty. Daniel is ordered into chains by Cyrus, but he pleads with the king for a moment of explanation. O king, he cries out according to this apocryphal story, look not only at this altar which is empty, but look on the floor. Last night as we toured the temple, I strewed ashes all over this floor. Look at the footprints which you will find on the floor. They go from yonder blank wall to the altar and back again. In that wall you will find a secret passage. For each night, the priests of this temple enter through that passage, come to the altar unbeknownst to the people, empty the altar of the votive offerings, and pass out again secretly from the temple. The story itself is an ingenious and an interesting one, and it must have strengthened many a weakening heart by showing up the shabby pretense to which these idol priests were forced to turn in order to sustain the belief of their peoples. It was obviously written in the years immediately preceding and during the early part of the Maccabean Rebellion. And interestingly also in this connection, the best history which we have of this Maccabean revolt is contained in the Apocrypha. It is known as the first book of the Maccabees. And together with the second book of the Maccabees, which is a somewhat longer and more miracle-filled and legendary retelling of the same story, it gives us an account of this great revolt, this great moment of glory in our Jewish tradition, quite unsurpassed in any other literature. Why is it that such a book of orthodox piety, of good history, a book which tells a history which redounds only to the glory of our people, why is it that this book should have been declared apocryphal and set aside, hidden away from our Jewish tradition? Why was it not included in our Bible? Part of the answer lies in the fact that the Bible was never intended to be an open-ended history of the Jewish people. The chronicle of biblical history was to end really with the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem after the return from the Babylonian exile. And the events of the Maccabean revolt in the second century before the Common Era simply happened too late in Jewish history to be included in the Bible proper. But there were other and more political reasons for the exclusion of the first and second books of Maccabees. The Hasmoneans, who were the descendant of the Maccabees, set up a monarchy in Palestine, and they ruled all Israel for a century and a quarter or a century and a half after the revolt. Many of the later monarchs who ascended the throne fell far from the standard of religious piety and morality which had been evidenced by their ancestors. They were often at odds with the religious elements within the Jewish community. And these elements were loath to enshrine in the Bible a book which redounded so to Hasmonean glory and seemed to give such a foundation, basis, to their claims and assumptions of power. And there was another political reason for the exclusion of the Book of Maccabees from the Bible. When Rome conquered Palestine, the religious leaders, the best minds of our people, were afraid that The reminders of the Maccabean achievement might stimulate over-enthusiastic young people to attempt a similar rebellion against Rome. And if by the miraculous intervention of God, the Jews had for a time been successful against the Syrian Greeks whose power was on the wane, these leaders knew full well that our people would not be successful against the might of Rome whose power was on the rise. And they therefore hid away the Book of the Maccabees, lest it stimulate overzealous, nationalistic-minded young people of Israel to attempt what would be only a catastrophic and a disastrous rebellion against Rome. And unfortunately, even though they hid the Book of the Maccabees away, the rebellion was attempted in the year 68 of the Common Era with the predicted and predictable disastrous results. And so we are faced with a very interesting paradox. And if you would read the most authentic account of the Hanukkah story, the greatest triumph of Jewish arms which has taken place in all of Jewish history till modern times, you must turn to a book which was hidden away by our ancestors, which was preserved for them only through the loving care of an errant daughter religion. There are then in the Apocrypha novelettes, other novelettes than the story of Daniel and Bel. There are some fine chronicles of Jewish history, other chronicles in the first and second book of Maccabees. There are also books of a variety of other types. There are books of worldly wisdom. One of the most famous of these was read to you this morning, the book of Ecclesiasticus, or as it is known in our Jewish tradition, the Wisdom of Ben Sirach. Ben Sirach was a citizen of Jerusalem a century or more before the Common Era. He was an urbane, cultivated gentleman, full of years and full of wisdom. And those of us who are still seeking for insight into our lives could do worse than to turn from time to time to these pages so full of wisdom and to drink deeply of his understanding of life. Permit me to add only a few lines of proverb taken and culled from the book of Ecclesiasticus from the Wisdom of Ben Sirach to those which have already been placed before you. Be on your guard, he advises, against advisers. Find out first what is to their advantage. It is better to work and have than to be overly proud and in want. Do not treat a man with disrespect when he is old, for some of us are growing old. Do not exult over a man who is dead, for all of us are going to die. Do not be rash in speech, but indolent and slack in action. Do not play the part of the lion in your house, and play the part of a sheep in the marketplace. And this last bit of good manners, which I'm sure many a hostess had wished was enshrined in the hearts of her guests, leave in good season, go home quickly, do not linger, do not be the last. There is more to the book of Ben Sirach than simply this kind of good advice on manners and etiquette. There was also some magnificent poetry, hymns in praise of God and praise of the great ancestors of Israel, worthy of the Book of Psalms itself. Permit me for a moment to read you one of the great visions of God, of the God seen through nature, which is included in the Book of Ben Sirach as the 43rd chapter of that book. The glory of the height is the firmament in its purity, the sight of the heavens with a spectacle of their splendor. The sun, when he appears making proclamation as he goes forth, is a wonderful instrument, the work of the Most High. At noonday, he dries up the country, and who can withstand his burning heat? He breathes out fiery vapors and shoots forth his beams, blinding men's eyes. Great is the Lord who made him, at whose command he hurries on his course. The moon, too, God places in its position at its season to mark times and to be an everlasting sign. The moon gives the sign for the festival, a light that wanes after reaching the full. The month is named after her. She increases marvelously as she changes, an instrument of the hosts on high, shining in the firmament of the heavens. The beauty of heaven is the glory of the stars. a system giving light in the highest places of the Lord. At the command of the Holy One, they take their places as God decrees, and they will not fail in their watches. See the rainbow, and bless him who made it, surpassingly beautiful in its brightness. It curves over the heaven in a glorious circle. The hands of the Most High have stretched it out. By his counsel, he brings the hurrying snow and makes swift the lightnings of his judgment. Because of his judgment, the storehouses are opened and the clouds fly out like birds. When God appears, the mountains shake, and at his wish, the south wind blows. He sprinkles the snow like birds fluttering down. It comes down softly like locusts settling. The eye is amazed at the beauty of its whiteness. The mind is astonished at its raining. God pours hoarfrost over the earth like salt, and when it freezes, it becomes sharp as points of thorns. The cold north wind blows. The ice freezes on the water. It forms on every pool of water, and the water puts it on like a breastplate. By God's counsel, he has stilled the deep and planted islands in it. Those who sail the sea tell of its dangers, and we wonder at what we hear with our ears. There are strange and wonderful works in it, all kinds of living things, the whale creation. We may say more, but we will not reach the end. And the conclusion of what we have to say is, he is the whole. Where can we find strength to glorify God, for he is greater than all his works? The Lord is awesome and exceedingly great, and his power is wonderful. Glorify the Lord and exalt him as much as you can. Even then, he will surpass it. Who has ever seen him so that he can describe him? Who can tell of God's greatness as it really is? Many things greater than these still remain hidden, for we have seen but few of his works. The Lord has made all things. Most of all, he has given wisdom to his creatures. If the Apocrypha contained material only of the type of Ecclesiasticus, of the Book of the Maccabees, and of the story of Daniel and Bel, it would certainly not have been hidden away so completely, so out of sight by our Jewish tradition. But it contains other materials. And it is these materials which caused our ancestors to turn aside rather completely from the religious creativity and inspiration of these books and to cast them aside in the passage of Jewish thought through history. The Apocrypha contains works which are apologetic in nature, material by which pious Jews sought to explain Judaism in a way attractive to their generation. There is in the Apocrypha a book known as the Wisdom of Solomon. In structure and in purpose, it is very like the Wisdom of Ben Sirach, an attempt to expound practical rules of conduct for the average person. But there is a second ulterior purpose in this book. The author was an Egyptian Jew, and apparently many of the young Jewish men and women of his day were attracted by the philosophies which were being taught in the Greek academies. And this author has structured all of his teachings in concepts and categories borrowed from Jewish thought, rather than from concepts and categories indigenous and instinctive to the Jewish tradition. He speaks, for instance, of pre-existence matter. He speaks of a rigid separation between body and soul. He speaks of God as the unmoved mover, rather than as the highly personal deity of our Jewish tradition. And though the book is deeply religious in character, our ancestors felt it important to push it aside, to hide it away, lest later generations feel that this Greek interpretation, this philosophic interpretation of Jewish thought, was acceptable within basic Jewish tradition. And this unacceptability of Greek thought made it acceptable to the Christian world. But with Paul and the incursion of Greek ideals into Christianity, Christian theology was for the most part structured within Platonic or Neoplatonic terms. And the wisdom of Solomon reflects many of the ideas which you will find in the later books of the New Testament and in patristic literature. And it won for itself, for that reason, a place of sympathy and respect within the Christian world. But besides the books of apologetics, there are apocryphal books in the apocalypse in the Apocrypha. By apocalypse, we mean books which seek to predict the end of the world, the coming of the Messiah, the arrival of the millennium, the time when all evil will be requited, when the just will be rewarded, when Israel will be freed, when mankind will be liberated from its shackles and allowed to enjoy a world of peace and of plenty. And it is these books which are the crux of the matter which we are to discuss this morning. Israel believes that there will be a time when every man will sit under his vine and under his fig tree and none shall be afraid. Israel's basic outlook is optimistic. It has been so since the inception of our religion. But during the 4th, 3rd, 2nd, 1st centuries before the Common Era and in the 1st century after the Common Era, Jews looking around at their world found little reason to hope. The Bible spoke of man achieving the millennium with the aid of God, of bringing about in his family, in his community, in his world, justice and righteousness and peace. But Israel in those days was a small nation, overwhelmed by powerful enemies who were neighbors. Israel was an oppressed nation, always being conquered and reconquered by one of its tyrannical foes. Times were difficult. The country was poor, the population was meager, and men came to believe more and more that God could not have intended this almost unending, certainly unceasing, poverty and misery and disaster to be the lot of the Jew. And whereas their earlier teachers had looked for a better world being achieved through the cooperation and the partnership of God and man, these later Jews began to look to a better world being achieved through the divine intervention, the miraculous divine intervention of God in the world. And so the Messiah, who was in earliest Jewish thought simply the anointed king of Israel who would through his power establish the liberty and freedom of Israel, became within these apocalyptic Jewish groups the sign, the symbol that God had miraculously intervened in the world. He would become in Christianity, which is an outgrowth in large measure of these apocalyptic groups, the agent, the divine agent by which God achieves this reversal of current order. Apocalyptic literature is for the most part highly symbolic. The authors try to foretell the exact dating and manner of the coming of the Messiah in highly difficult and ingenious symbolisms, which it is almost impossible for us of a later age to unravel. But that these works were popular among certain sects of pious believing Jews is undoubted, and that they became more popular each year as the Syrian Greeks, and then the Hasmonean tyrants, and finally the Roman overlords oppressed and reoppressed our Jewish people. They represent a tendency which is psychologically understandable in Jewish life, but which was philosophically unacceptable to normative Judaism. We know of many of these sects. Dead Sea Scroll Covenanteers, the people of Kirbat Qumran, were exactly of this type. Men who felt that the end of the world was imminent, that their main purpose was to leave the city, to flee to the desert, to purify their souls, to prepare themselves for the advent of the Messiah. The Essenes and the Therapeutae of our Jewish tradition are others of these types. And John the Baptist and Jesus were also individuals within the context of these sectarian, messianistic Jewish sect. These pious Jewish men and women who simply could not accept the idea that God had imposed the heaviness of this burden upon them, and who felt that God must shortly relieve them of this burden and free them of this overwhelming oppression. Now, certainly the Jewish teachers who set aside these apocalyptic books shared in their heart of hearts the hope that God, by some miraculous means, might intervene in the world and bring about for the Jew a better life. But they knew that the basic direction of Jewish thought had always been this, that God's plans are not of man's concern, but man must plan in his own way, within whatever feeble means are at his possession, to achieve in the immediacy of his family, in the larger circle of his community, of his nation, and his world, whatever measure of peace and tranquility and injustice it is possible for him to achieve. Judaism rejected the despair in which apocalyptic messianism was born. Judaism affirmed life. It did not negate life. Judaism affirmed that it was man's responsibility not to flee into the desert to prepare himself for some other life, but to look within his own community, within his own family, for direction, for purpose, to develop their plans of betterment for all. And so, feeling the popularity of these messianic apocalyptic groups, our ancestors felt it necessary to hide the works of this group, to set them aside that they might not delude and mislead our Jewish people. They might not give them vain hopes for an immediate end of their troubles and leave them unprepared to cope with the daily problems of living. Judaism rejected then despair. Judaism rejected the escapist nature of this literature. For Jewish life has always affirmed life rather than death. Choose life that you may live. And if one were to seek to understand the parting of the ways, that which caused Judaism to separate itself from Christian thought, and that which caused Christian thought to separate himself from Judaism, one would do worse than to concentrate an understanding of the direction and the philosophies of this apocalyptic literature. For here is the line in which Judaism drew. This far will we go in permitting freedom of thought, freedom of religious expression. But when one concentrates all of his enthusiasms on preparing himself for some future life, that far we will not go. For our enthusiasm must be in this world and for this life. Jewish teachers were conscious that if they permitted apocalyptic material to become a basic ingredient in Jewish life, it would be only a short step until Jews had accepted a great deal of the angelology and the mythology, which led to much of the myth which our Christian neighbors are celebrating this day. Now, Jews need not question the moral earnestness or the religious piety of these messianic apocalyptic groups. And Christians need not question or challenge the moral earnestness or the piety of Jewish, basic normative Jewish groups who rejected this apocalyptic vision. But the essential difference of our two great faiths can be seen in this rejection by Jews and this acceptance by Christianity. Judaism emphasizes morality rather than any theology which interprets and makes real God's plans to man. Christianity has emphasized the making real of God's way as well as the understanding of the better way which man is to live. The apocalyptic literature is an interesting literature. The apocryphal literature, of which it is only a part, is a grand and glorious literature. We can thank the Christian Church for having saved this literature for us, especially if we take some time, each of us, to browse in this material, to drink deeply of the fountains of wisdom which it can and will make real to us. Amen.